Notice how now a phrase that we used exactly a year ago becomes very important to us again. The phrase was from Suzanne Langer from her collection of essays, Philosophies of Art. And in there, the phrase that I excerpted out, her phrase that has so much felicity. It really took a great woman philosopher to be able to make the poignant statement. Her words were, I'm scouting the possibility that thinking is an elaboration of feeling. There is no masculine philosopher ever who has managed to say that and mean it. There have been some who have come to that conclusion, but there are very few. In fact, I can't think of a single one who has managed to say that as a basis upon which one then moves. Not the conclusion, not the mystical conclusion, but the beginning compass which sets your orientation in a foundational way. Her words, I am scouting the possibility that thought is an elaboration of feeling. Now, it's a protean phrase. I mean, it's really a seed. And just to give you an indication, she wrote three large volumes that were published by Johns Hopkins University called Mind, An Essay on Feeling. Mind, An Essay on Feeling. They're all in paper bound now. It is a tremendously protean insight. And Mrs. Langer was indeed a sage of a first quality. She studied with Ernst Cassirer and Alfred North Whitehead, and she's a capable gal, a really great mind. There aren't many women who become world-class philosophers, but Suzanne Langer's on the level of Hypatia in antiquity. When she was lecturing at the University of Washington in Pullman, she lived outside of town in a place that had no electricity because she didn't want any electricity. She wanted to keep herself sparse, so that she could think clearly, because her thought was, as she knew, an elaboration of her feelings. She didn't want to clutter her feelings up with all kinds of irrelevancies. And her swept back white hair just seemed to go with the kind of forward penetration of her eyes. A real American eagle, Suzanne. The point being that in order to understand thought, one has to be in conscious possession of your feelings. There's no way that you can understand what you are thinking if your feelings are unconscious to you. And so endemic is this with the masculine form of humanity that the projection is universal, that one depends upon some woman to do the feeling for you consciously. And hence the phrase, I don't know what I would do without you. Which is more true than any of them would like to admit. And it isn't just the wife or the little woman, it's the mother, it's all sorts of things. It's Kuan Yin, it's the Virgin Mary, it's Sophia. That's no way to treat a lady, hanging on to her. If she wants to be there, that's fine, but to commandeer her is a true mistake. It's a mistake of the ego. Notice here that if thought does not clear itself up until feeling is conscious, and the only way that thought and feeling are contiguous enough to be seen as a whole is to have the experience of the deep self, the equanimity of the deep self, there is no way to really be the person who you are without the insight of self-realization. There's no way that you can be who you are without the insight of self-realization. I'll take a break in just 1 minute. The kicker in here is that when your person has that insight, the insight is that there is no deep self there. There's no point there. There's only the flow of the continuity. Hence, one realizes there's also no person here as a thing. What's here at best is a frame of reference through which the flow occurs. An openness through which the flow of energy occurs. It's very, very tough for the ego, because the ego realizes that there's no peg anywhere in the psyche for it to hang its coat. But the great, wonderful discovery is that because there's no peg for it to hang its coat, it doesn't need the goddamn coat. And throwing off this worldly garment which disguises you, you occur in your nude radiance. And you realize that you don't focus on a screen that's here in your person, but that the energies go through what was the person, and the liberated energies going through the person are what is the spirit. Let's take a break. I'm wearing a elastic gold string because it wrapped one of my birthday presents. And I'm wearing it because synchronicity always works in resonance of the self. What is the resonance of the self? The spirit. What is the spirit? The resonance of the self. In the old Theravada, in the old path, when they would chant together, the monks would hold a gold thread. Gold as an element, you might know, is ductile. It's able to be spun very, very fine. And it can be spun into a thread. And in the Theravada, the monks, when they would chant together, would hold in their collective mudra a gold thread. It was a symbol of the flow passing through them. The gold thread, the golden thread, was like the umbilical of their birth into the Dharma. Were one of them to not hold the thread, the flow would still go, but that person would be excerpted from the flow. It's not that the Tao doesn't flow, that it gets stopped up. That's the wrong understanding. Nothing stops the Tao. But it's that you're disconnected from it. You don't light up. St. John remembered Jesus saying, trying to get across to the wealthy but psychically alert Nicodemus, he said, "No one knows from whence the wind blows, nor whither it goes." Nobody knows where the spirit comes from, nor where it goes. Why is this so? Because there's no beginning, and there's no end. In the ecology of the real, It never not happens. This physical universe is 20,000 million years old. There's no age to the pneuma. Jesus, when he wanted to make a point, spoke Greek. He spoke Aramaic so that people could hear, but when he wanted to make a point, he spoke Greek. No one, the word for wind is not ruch, but pneuma. No one knows where the spirit comes from nor where it goes, because those are irrelevant questions. They're extraneous questions. Only an ego would ask such questions. Only an egotistical viewpoint. The Tao that can be named is not the Tao. But the Tao that can be named is the mother of the 10,000 things. Notice that the mother, the Kuan Yin, the Sophia, the Mary, only comes into play in a symbolic, metaphorical, projective way in this world, in this worldliness. All mythological structures are family structures. What holds a mythology together is the family of the gods. There are not just myths. That's a misunderstanding. All myths are in a family structure. So in order to understand the structure, one has to understand the divine family. If you don't know the divine family, in ancient Akkadia, you cannot understand Sumerian mythology. It's a telling indication. The point is not so much that there is a family structure to mythology, that's just one of the little examples, but the point is that the structure of the real to us is exact. It's very definite. So that one cannot guess one's way. You have to know. You have to be a knower. You have to know what it is, and your knowing can be as precise as you can possibly make it. There is no science until you understand the exactness, the specificity of the real. Then there is a science of being. But for you to be there in a way that you can understand the specificity of the real in the science of being, you have to have mastered the art of living first. Or to be technical about it, concomitantly. They occur together. And the art of the person is to know that there is no thing there except the designation person. The magical language that designates person makes it there. By giving it a name, you have made it there in its name. But what the referent is for the name is not the thing itself. In a magical language, the referent is not nature, but the deep self. And when the reference of that creative language, the Greek term for that creative language was poiesis, to make by saying so. One of Wallace Stevens' great poems, in the idea of order at Key West, Thou art not august unless I say, make thee so. She sang beyond the genius of the sea, and the sea, whatever self it had, was in the song which she singing made. Pale Ramon, tell me, was there ever a world for her other than this? Who is the maker of the sea? Who is the maker of the song? Wallace Stevens. Again, the point, the place where the finger of the lesson is raised. Psychic energy is specific. It always manifests exactly where it really does, and not just in an ambiguous hodgepodge. The psyche has a structure, therefore. It's not just a happening. It is a happening with a structure. One can know. You do not have to guess. You can know. All energy has that specificity. I talked Thursday night in the PRS Science in Our Spirit series, which is dovetailing with this Saturday Science series. Those 13 lectures go with these 13 lectures. They go together like the two hands folded together to make a prayer. They go like that. There are prayer that the 90s will be different from the 80s. Talked about Thursday night about the philosophy of Niels Bohr, who is the great architect of ideas for quantum mechanics, which is the basic nuclear physics understanding of the real, and the essential overall framework of understanding Bohr called complementarity. And he brought that phrase out in 1927, September of 1927 in Como, Italy, at a conference there. And one of the great combines there was Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein coming together through the glue of two other brilliant young men, Erwin Schrödinger and Werner Heisenberg. And it's kind of interesting when one looks at that quartet and you can see that Schrödinger and Einstein and Bohr and Heisenberg in 1927 are very much an expression of symbolic wholeness of the human consciousness. You have two Jews and two people from a Germanic Protestant background. Bohr, even though he was Danish, was very close. It's incredible that in 1927 that one would have a Jewish-German expression of the deep self, which was as accurate as any that has ever been made, and only 6 years later, one would find these two parts of that wholeness fractured into an antagonism that became catastrophic. I'm saying this to remind you that reality has a sizzle to it. And you can light up the world by it, or you can electrocute the world by it. It's the same energeia. And the bodhisattva activity in our time is to make sure that the electrocution doesn't happen, because the energy is flowing. There's no way to turn it off. This little sheet that I handed out on Thursday, I hand out again. It shows this photograph of Einstein and Bohr a couple years later at the Solvay conference, walking together. And next to it is Planck's constant, an article from the McGraw-Hill Encyclopedia of Science. Max Planck, in 1900, discovered by working with the mathematics of what was then called black body radiation, discovered that energy is not on a kind of a continuum that is indefinitely able to be subdivided. Energy is not ambiguous, but energy occurs in reality only at discontinuous discrete levels, frequencies. One of the manifestations is radio. The only way that you can have radio is because you have stations which you can tune in. What are the stations? They are frequency levels at which something can occur. Same for television, television channels. Why are there not an infinite number of television channels? Because there are only discrete, limited places where you can tune in. In other words, the discovery was that energy is discontinuous in its continuity. Well, the continuity is there unbroken in spirituality. In this world, it is fragmented, but fragmented according to an exact, precise structure. It's not broken into bits, but it is screened into discrete levels. The magic, the hermetic magic of wisdom is to see that this world operates because of the discontinuity of this world being connected invisibly by the flow of the real. This world manifests, in fact, only what it can. Only what it can. And that those manifestations have a structure. Planck found, in fact, that the frequencies at which energy can manifest in this universe are all multiples of a single number. Incredible. That once you know that magic number, you know what possible frequencies there are forever anywhere in a manifested universe, whether it's this universe or a parallel universe or any other universe. It is a fundamental law. And the information to start you off is here, and you can see the value of Planck's constant, usually written with an H in mathematical equations, nuclear physics equations, sometimes an H with a little slash at the top, but generally it's H. And its value is 6.6256 times 10 to the minus 7, 27th ergs per second. It's very small, but it is definite. Again, the point being that psychic energy as an energy has a very definite patterning. It occurs only at very precise multiples, which are stages along the way. Now, no one's done this. I don't know if it's true, but I would suspect in insight that if one took the range that the neurological, psychoneurological system that a human being has, if one took the full range, there would be 108 manifesting levels, frequencies, which man could distinguish. In other words, man could distinguish 108 channels. I don't know if that's true, but my insight rather suspects that that could be confirmed, that that scientifically could be determined. Some 21st century neurological yogi will probably investigate that and find that out. Again, for the fourth time, the point is, all energy in its manifestation is discrete and specific. To measure it accurately takes a science. And that science is a spiritual discipline, because only the spirit can move freely in that accuracy. The egotistical person, no matter how sophisticated they are, no matter how powerful they are, is too clumsy an instrument to understand the real. The ego at its finest is just simply an elephant in a tea shop. And the only thing that you can do is to charm yourself in your dance by breaking the goodies. And that's hardly adequate. Excuse the sarcasm. What is the way in which science then operates? It operates in an empirical mode. In an empirical mode of discovery. Discover. Not just uncover, but to discover by parting the illusion one sees. By parting the clouds, one sees the full moon. Discovery, empirical discovery. Where's the empiricism? The empiricism is to know that the real is there and the appearance must be parted. One does not work on the basis of using the world as a referent, because the world is an appearance. The science is not to be fooled by the appearance, but to know that the real is there, even though it's hidden, even though it's invisible, and to learn how to discover empirically what is really there. Science is spiritual. Not because it hopes to be or wants to be, but because it is. The activity itself is a spiritual discipline. The spiritual discipline, science of being. This has always been so. It's not just the 20th century. Science has made it so. It's quite clear that in the yogi aphorisms of Patanjali, or the Aeneids of Plotinus, or the Madhyamika of Nagarjuna, it was understood exactly, completely, and wholly. One can see that Jesus understood it, the Buddha understood it, that Lao Tzu understood it. There's just no way not to understand that the preciseness was understood. The capacity to express that understanding has increased in our time. The expressive capacity, the ability to write out in magic language of higher mathematics and so forth, that is new. That increased capacity has been discovered. So that in our particular generation, we live at a time when the momentum of this has reached a certain strategic point. In other words, if you were to study this, and the phenomenon of this would be the growth of ideas, in history of ideas, it would be the growth of ideas, one would come to see that there is a lifetime of an idea. From its appearance in a single mind to its acceptance on a general level in the population is about 150 years. then the idea becomes a part of the fabric of tradition. But the growth of an idea is about 150 years, so that the thrust of the idea, the power, the maximum power of the idea, is right after the halfway point. From the halfway point to about two-thirds point. Imagine to yourself a javelin. If you're going to throw the javelin, if you grip it before the halfway point, you're not going to get any distance or accuracy. At the halfway point, you can balance it on your hand, but to throw it, you have to go beyond the halfway point back, further. And the optimum place to throw it, of course, is about two-thirds of the way back. That is to say, if you're going to throw it by hand. If you're going to throw it by a technological amplification, you make an instrument to hold it at the end of it, and you throw it from two-thirds, but your throwing instrument holds it from two-thirds of the way. Your hand is two-thirds, but the instrument is on the end. This is called, because of its anthropological origins, the word is atl. The growth of the history of an idea, then, has a very precise development, roughly 150 years. So that if you look, Planck's discovery of the universal quanta of energy came in 1900. 150 years would be 2050. 2050. Halfway would be 1975. So by 1990 out of 150, 90 out of 150, 9 of 15, 3 of 5, 3/5, 60%. So 1990 is about 60%. It's getting to the place to where one could throw the idea with its optimum power. And if one understood the principle well enough, one could make an instrument that would manifest in 2050, in 2050, but one could use it in 1995 to throw this idea with as much power as could possibly be manifested. That's what's going on here, is to throw this idea that there is a science of the spirit just as hard as possible at the phantom of ignorance. That has resonance. On the basis of Planck's constant, it took a while for it to sink in. Nobody knew really what to do with this. No one believed it. First of all, Planck thought he had made a mistake. It wasn't until around 1913 that in the mind of Niels Bohr, he began to get visions, and I have to use that term, visions. He began to get visions that there was something there that he was trying to recognize. In other words, something in him really deep was tugging at his attention to say, there's something here for you to recognize. And it took him a long time. It took him 12 years before he began to get into that kind of agitated state where it was coming out, rain or shine. But what was it? What was it? And Bohr himself, at this time, was about 40 years old. And he was mature enough to know that you have to back off a little bit and let it occur, let it happen. Sometimes the best cooking is to let it simmer for a while. Don't keep stirring it. Let the juices settle. Sometimes when you get to be a little more mature, you realize that the creative process needs to be let be. Don't keep bugging it. Let it be for a while. Let the flavors meld. Let it alone. And one of the ways in which he was letting things alone is that he was being very open with his graduate students at the Bohr Institute. And one of his prize graduate students at that time was Werner Heisenberg. And Heisenberg was younger and more brazen, as it were, as a young student should be. And in his genius to respond to this profound agitation in his teacher, his vaulting genius came up with what we understand now as matrix mechanics, ingenious mathematical strategy of how to express what seemed to be paradoxical and inexpressible. And as long as one has line logic mathematics, you cannot understand anything outside of the line of argument. And what one was trying to understand was not just the line of argument, but the invisible resonances around it. And to understand the whole of that, the movement and its resonances together. And Heisenberg's matrix mechanics was an ingenious mathematical solution to this. It allowed you to do this. And Bohr, half falling over himself with joy that his student should be able to do this, that they had finally found a way to talk about the incommensurate with exactness. And just a few months later, out of left field, out of nowhere, the young, brilliant Erwin Schrödinger came up with the exact opposite technique that also allowed you to express the inconceivable exactly, mathematically, his wave mechanics. And it threw the entire intellectual world of about 12 people who knew what was happening into complete chaos. How can there be two quite polar opposite, distinct ways of talking exactly about this? That doesn't make sense. In anybody's universe, that's crazy. And that's where the teacher comes in. To find a way to bring the polar incommensurates into some kind of workable unity. And Bohr, the next year, 1927, January of 1927, came up with complementarity, that both Heisenberg's matrix mechanics and Schrödinger's wave mechanics both worked because the phenomenal reality included both. It was a both and, as we used to say in the 60s. It was a both and quality of mind. You didn't have to make a pick. You don't have to choose one or the other. The two, though seemingly polarized, actually go together, so use them together in good health. Just because it doesn't seem like they should go together, don't base yourself on what seems to be. Don't let them tell you what to do. Do what you know is right. And so the old ancient ethic came into play in place of the omnipresent false moray. The social moray is, you better pay attention to what they're saying. But the ethic is, do what you know is right. You have to have a little James Dean in you, as they used to say. You've got to turn your collar up, fishtail your car out of the garage and drive off into the night. Bohr, when he came up with complementarity, stunned the world. Now in 1927, when that idea came up, almost nobody was able to accept it. even Bohr, used to use a little story, a Hasidic story, to express what he felt about it. The story was that, I'll read it to you so that you can get it in the form in which it's here. So it's exacting. Or perhaps I can't find it. He used to use this story. The young man went to hear a rabbi speak, a brilliant rabbi. Here it is. The citizens of a small Jewish community sent one of their brightest young men to hear the teachings of a famous rabbi in a nearby city. The young man returned with the following report. The rabbi spoke three times. The first talk was brilliant, clear, and simple. I understood every word. The second was even better, deep and subtle. I didn't understand much, but the rabbi understood all of it. The third was by far the finest, a great and unforgettable experience. I understood nothing, and the rabbi didn't understand much either. That was the quality of experience that Bohr was having at that time. He knew what he did not know was specificity, to put it in a kind of a Zen paradox. He knew with great specificity what he did not know. And that's a shocker. And the first couple of thousand times that occurs to you, you get nervous. How is it that I know what I don't know? That I know that I don't know? How is that? How in the world does that happen? And you can stumble around for as long as you like carrying that quandary, and it doesn't go away. Because the feeling tone of that quandary is precise. Nowhere in this world does that energy mode register. It doesn't register in this world. There's no place in this world for that specific energy to register. The Son of Man has no place to lay his head. It's not a lament, oh, we don't have any place. It's a moment of triumph, of insight. There is no place in this world that on that level of manifestation we are at home. Our home on that level is not here in this world. It does exist. We do manifest exactly at that frequency, but not here. Do you understand? It's the spiritual insight at the scientific level that we occur in our reality also someplace else, not here. Not here in any mode. It's not only not here in California, it's not here in space-time. To know that is like taking a real deep breath for the first time. You're only using the air. You don't own it. You don't need to own it. It's there to use, to take in and integrate, to exhale and let go. That's the spiritual process of the prana. You're only here to use that energy. You don't need to own it. And you especially don't have to stuff your pockets with it. What pockets are going to hold that? You see? There's a liberating quality in the actuality of it. It's like the snap of the finger in insight. You're infinitely wealthy in terms of the real. You also have versatellers everywhere in the universe. You can cash the checks at any time, much as you need. What happens to the suitcases full of ego-bound worry? You let them go. Why in the world are you carrying around that luggage? There's no place that you're going that you can dress in those things anyway. Where you're going, nude radiance is the mode of the day, always. So that the costuming of the ornate world is just simply extraneous. We need to change, do we?